You're listening to the Geekly Chronicles, recorded on Thursday, the 26th of January, 2012.
We've been away for 3 weeks, and it's been a long time, but we're back, and we've got some amazing things in the pipeline. If you look at our website, you will see that it's currently undergoing a bit of a change, and we will be revealing more about that in the coming days. But we've got a great show for you today. We're going to be talking about some really interesting things, aren't we, Ben?
That's right. We've got a discussion around the posted profit earnings of various different companies. Unfortunately, companies like Kodak going into to filing for bankruptcy and that kind of thing. We've also got a look at some of the tech news that's been going on in the past couple of weeks, and a look at some of the events we've been to, so Bet and Learning Without Frontiers. We also have an interview with Rob Hawkes from Mozilla. What are we going to be talking about there?
So yes, Rob's an evangelist at Mozilla, and we're going to be finding out a little bit more about who he is and what he does and some of the things that he thinks the internet could do with and do without. And of course, we'll be also putting questions to him from Twitter, Skype and Facebook and all the other great ways that people can get in touch with us.
We're also then going to have a bit of a debate around file sharing and things like SOPA and ACTA and the recent Mega Upload case. So hearing all about your thoughts on that. So, James, let's get started.
It's the Geekly Chronicles with Ben and James. They know the rules and so do you.
News.
We need like an intro to that section, like some ominous kind of
news.
Well, we'll look at some new jingles soon. It's been an eventful few weeks when it comes down, and it's that kind of time of year where companies start announcing profit margins and that kind of thing. But a really, really sad time on the 19th of January for a 133-year-old company. I'm talking about Eastman Kodak, who have filed for bankruptcy protection. Now, Kodak is... no matter how young or old you are, you hear Kodak and it will trigger something. It's a really well-known brand. Now, when I was younger, Kodak was very much that was the film you bought if you wanted good film for your camera. And it's been around for a while. 1883, the company was founded.
You remember that being formed?
No, I do not remember that being formed. Thank you, though, making me feel nice and young. And in 1888, it launched the first ever consumer camera, and the slogan was, you press the button, we do the rest. It pretty much set the standard for easy-to-use modern cameras.
That was the slogan in when, 1888?
1888, yeah. That's right. 1900, they introduced a consumer camera for $1, which was the best-selling camera in America for quite some time. And they actually invented the world's first digital camera. So they were the first to pioneer digital camera technology, but a lesson to us all about how important thinking about how you're actually going to market and sell a product, because they did nothing with it. They pioneered the technology, they didn't really create products, and everyone else got there kind of first in the market. And really that, as many people have commented, was a way forward. There was a great quote from Rupert Goodwins, who is the editor of ZDNet, who said, "Kodak made all its money in selling film, then the digital camera came along, and now nobody buys film. It's not like they didn't see it coming, and they hesitated because they didn't want to kill their own business. They made a lot of money in film. They didn't want to push digital because they thought it would kill film. Unfortunately, digital has killed film, and they were behind the times." So,
I don't know if it's... I think there'll always be a small place for film, amongst enthusiasts.
Well,
it's
a small place.
It's a very small place.
Having this conversation with other people the other day, when you get a camera, you get a digital camera, you can take hundreds of photos and just keep them. And we were going through... the last time I was back home, my mum dragged out the baby photos, and we were going through them all, and actually... When you're limited to film that wasn't cheap, and so sometimes from a kind of a poor family, you can only afford to get films for special occasions for the camera, and they came in either 24 or 36 photos. So you've got 24 photos from like 2 points a year, whereas now we take pictures of everything on our phones. While we're maybe a bit too snap happy, you think about kids who are growing up today will have so many more pictures of their lives and their memories than they would have done.
I think you're right. But what I would say is that in some ways, I think that's almost a bad thing. So it's funny that you should mention about getting the photos out, because I went home recently and one of the things that I did was take out a photo album. And of course, inside this album, beautifully arranged into these pockets and all written in with all the dates and locations, were photo after photo of things that happened to me as a child and things that my family did when I was very, very young. But of course, I was looking at those things. They were physical, I could touch them, hold them, and they were very easy to access. I have a digital camera, and I take hundreds and hundreds of photos, and I file them away, and they get stored on my computer in beautiful high resolution, and I never print them out, I never look at them. They just seem to accrue in this big archive.
But that's not film's fault or the lack of film's fault. That's just you not printing them out, though.
But what I'm saying is, in order to see those photos in the old days, so to speak, you had no choice but to have the physical copies. Now it's a very disposable medium, and it's just easy to, you know, fill your boots full of photos and never have to think about what you're taking a picture of.
Well, I guess. I mean, it's an interesting debate. But at any rate, very sad news that Kodak have filed for bankruptcy. It's sad times. But also, in the tech world, both Microsoft and Google posted, quarterly profits. At Google, they had a 27% increase in revenue, but they'd had estimates, and they didn't meet them. So they fell really quite far short of the estimates that had been made. So they had a strong quarter, they've had some growth, but they haven't grown anywhere near as much as they'd predicted that they would recently. So Microsoft, on the other hand, they saw their quarterly profits fall slightly year on year, but actually had a better quarter and a better kind of half of the financial year than predicted. So they're kind of doing okay, but they fell slightly on last year. And actually, people were predicting that it was going to be a lot worse for both Microsoft and for Google. Google's was a bit more of a shock. It's one of the first times in recent years that Google's revenue has been a lot worse than anticipated. But both those companies, they're still making money, still meeting targets. So it's quite interesting that the tech sector is still plowing on. Of course, Apple posting record profits once again. But then, I mean, Apple is seeing massive growth. They're going from that small tech company to being a really big player. And, you know, they're getting that share of devices. And the really interesting thing is that it always used to be about desktop operating systems and that kind of thing, whereas now, actually, for the first time this year, we're seeing massive outselling of handheld devices compared to traditional desktops and laptops and that kind of thing. And Apple obviously have a huge part of the market there with the iPhone.
Well, yeah, and they also have a huge pile of cash, which I know that investors are getting nervous about. Apparently, I was reading, all of this information has been coming out, that apparently Apple's share price, analysts reckon it should be higher, but the reason it's not is because they're just sat on all of this cash, and people are saying, well, what are they going to do with it? And don't forget, they've apparently got more money than the Federal Reserve. I mean, these guys have got enough to keep going forever.
And perhaps break away and start their own country, maybe.
Yeah, come and live.
Buy an island and you can come and live at Apple.
Yeah, you can only get in if you have an iDevice.
Well, I think there are several millions of people passport. That can get in and get one of those. But yeah, so that's quite interesting. It's certainly something good to watch. Other kind of little bits of news from the tech scene. We're going to be talking about Mega Upload a bit later on as we debate that. And we're going to talk about Sopa and Actor and all of that stuff and Mega Upload and get your thoughts on that. So keep thinking about that. Interesting news today. Now I talk very strongly about antivirus software because things like, Norton in particular maybe get people panicking a bit about things that might not actually really be wrong with their computer. But when you make a dialog box all red and pop up with, if you don't update now, you may die, people get a bit
nervous.
Paranoid about it. And Symantec today, they shipped this software called PC Anywhere, which is kind of its antivirus and anti-malware thing. And they actually issued a statement today asking people to stop using it because the software itself had been compromised thanks to poorly written source code.
Really?
So that's, I'm sure, not going to make any people less nervous about the whole thing. But it's worth noting that actually a lot of free solutions are out there that deal with that kind of thing. Also, quite interestingly, there was what was being dubbed as Headergate just a couple of days ago, where O2 customers realised that O2 were sending their mobile numbers in header information, and I confirmed it on my O2 mobile, and within a matter of hours, the issue had been fixed, and O2 issued an apology. And actually, hats off to O2 for doing such a great job on social media and email of answering all their customers and apologising and saying, you know what, this was an old thing. We've changed it. We're sorry.
Yeah. So, no, I have to say, kudos to O2. I was very surprised when I checked out their Twitter account and saw that they were responding, you know, to each and every person that was contacting them. And then they put out a statement. Everything was dealt with very, very quickly, and they seemed to be quite transparent about it. And they seemed to be cooperating with the Information Commissioner's Office as well. So, you know, in fairness, it's fine to, you know, make a mistake as long as you sort of admit it and correct it. They've done exactly that. You know, I can't fault them for being honest.
Yeah, absolutely. There's another little piece of tech news that you're going to pick up before talking about stuff, which I think is kind of nice.
Oh, are you referring to Facebook?
No, I was referring to the underground getting Wi-Fi, but we can talk about Facebook. Facebook is rolling out Timeline,
of course,
to everyone.
So,
as a forced update, as I understand.
Well, no, I mean, the Timeline has been around for a little while. So, if you've been a Facebook developer, then you've been able to get access to it. So,
well, I've had Timeline for some time,
a few months, and then, of course, you've been able to activate it. And I think, you know, the logical step with all of these things is you have an early adopter phase, then an opt-in phase, and then you kind of force it on everyone. And it seems that that time is quickly approaching, and soon every user of Facebook will have this Timeline enabled.
Well,
for
you
their
know,
profile.
When I first tried it, I thought, oh, this is awful. But as I've got used to it and started adding things, and I quite like it.
I quite like it. I have to say, I've never been a huge fan of the way Facebook handle their privacy options and all the rest of it. But actually, their current iteration, if you like, the Timeline and the way it's easy to see who you're sharing information with, personally I find that a lot easier than it's ever been. But I know it raises quite a few concerns with people.
Absolutely. And a tweet just came in from Tom. I don't like Facebook. I have 70 friends and it keeps forcing me to get more, and I can't hide my profile from outside users. So I mean, there's interesting to see the various different discussions that go on around Facebook privacy settings and all of that. I think it's certainly a debate that goes on and on. So it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts and feelings. We'll visit that back on the hashtag later in the show.
But anyway, to talk about the story you thought I was going to talk about, that's right. So this year sees London have the Olympics hosted there for 2012.
I hadn't heard about that.
Did you not know? Just to let you know, so the Olympics, that every 4-year event.
What's the Olympics?
It's the things that you never do. So sports, being physically active, you know, running around, jumping, throwing things.
Wearing a Speedo.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, you'd be arrested for that. So let's not enter you for that. But the Olympics are coming to London, and that's not such a bad thing if you like being able to use your phone or wireless device on the underground, because for the London Olympics, it seems that Transport for London has confirmed that 120 of the 270, I think, tube stations will be getting wireless access for the Olympics.
And this is just at the stations, right?
Well, yes, there'll be access across London, but this is specifically underground in the stations in a way that we've not seen before. I know that BT piloted this recently at Charing Cross, and it seems that that pilot has been successful. They're now widening that out to say, 120 stations. So while the underground is probably going to be chock-a-block during the Olympics, at least when you're stood there in a massive queue crammed, you'll be able to tweet. So that's good.
I do always think to myself that Twitter on the underground is dangerous, because everyone always comments about, oh, there was a really freaky looking person on my journey. There was this really odd guy stood at the platform. People will be able to tweet and twitpick that now. That's going to add a whole new dimension to London tweets.
Exactly. But I think the good thing, you know, VoIP services notwithstanding, I think the good thing is this doesn't extend to 3G. So, you know, you won't be getting the awful Nokia ringtone on the carriage, you know, or any of those kind of things, people having very loud Dom Jolly-esque conversations. It will be limited just to Wi-Fi, but I think that's a good thing. I don't think I would want telephones on the underground.
Well, and so many people stood there in a packed tube carriage or on a packed platform trying to have a telephone call there's just no privacy there, is there? It's like that one person that talks really loudly into their phone on the train. Like, hello? Yeah. No, I know that I said I'd wear the dress, but I'm actually going to not wear anything.
There's someone else on the phone.
Yeah.
Yes. No, it's not what you want.
I couldn't. That's not a conversation I've ever heard. But I see tweets quite a lot about people that are having impossibly loud phone conversations. That's fine. You could still Skype, Lewis says. Yes, you could.
What's I say? Not so as a VoIP stuff,
Skyping,
notwithstanding.
FaceTime, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
George said, we'll see more uploaded videos of disgraceful people on the tube, like that very racist woman last year.
Yes, I can believe
interesting.
That
would be interesting.
Well, of course, there was that. There was somebody recorded a video on their phone. They didn't do it underground, obviously, but they recorded a video of a Transport for London, conductor attendant on the platform being incredibly aggressive to a man who was causing trouble on a train. So I think, you know, it would be interesting to see how people do.
A whole new dimension of whistleblowing.
Show what goes on underground.
Indeed.
Literally.
So, James, bet.
Bet, yes. So. I was at Bet. You were also at Bet. But
I was there for a couple of days.
You were only there for a couple of days. I was there for the whole thing. So we got there on the Tuesday, which is a kind of pre-day, and I was there all the way through until, you know.
So remind me, what is Bet?
Bet is a huge educational technology show, which up until this year took place in Olympia in London. It actually moves next year, but for the past few years it's been Olympia, and it's basically a sort of a exhibition show. It's not a trade show necessarily, but it's a massive exhibition hall full of all the big players and the little ones in the educational technology space. So everyone from the big players like Microsoft, Google, RM, down to, you know, individuals with stalls selling triangular pencils that can't roll off the desk.
Now, Google had smoothies.
Google did have smoothies.
Which made me smile. The only downside, of course, was that when the internet went away, everything that that Google was showing else that was showing that was entirely internet-based had a bit of a demo fail.
There was an awkward 2.5 hours where nobody had internet access in Olympia, and there were some rather red faces when none of Google stuff worked.
Well, indeed, or anyone that were doing cloud service things. But... I went along and I had a look around, and it's interesting to see the difference between what companies think education needs and what education really needs. And I think it's always going to be quite interesting at a show like that. The thing that got me is there were a lot of students wandering around the place. Some people that I know are listening in tonight were there, and it was interesting because they were going around saying, well, this is rubbish and that's rubbish and that's really good and I quite like that, but why would I ever use this in a school and why would we ever want to use that? And it's really interesting to see the difference between the companies that have done their homework, no pun intended, and the companies that haven't, which was quite interesting. But you were talking at Bet, weren't you? You were doing a talk on the Microsoft stand about...
I was there doing a presentation on Link, which is it's an instant message voice video collaboration thing, and I was
so
doing
basically Skype.
Although if you'd come to me on the stand and ask me that question, I would have an answer for you. But as I don't have my work hat on at the moment, I'm going to avoid that. But no, it was a fantastic opportunity. I was presenting once a day. It was a nice talk, and it seemed to go down very well. But yes, there were lots of other talks from people on the stands. In fact, this year saw 30,300 people go through, which is the highest attendance ever.
That's a lot of people.
It's a lot. I mean, I've been to Bet 7 years. This was my seventh Bet now, and I remember the Friday is always the busiest day. You couldn't move for people on the Friday.
And Olympia is a big place.
It's a huge place. So to have it that, I mean, it was five people deep in certain places. It was ridiculous. I mean, all of them
stood on top of each other.
Of course, yeah. You know, crowd surfing to get to places. But no, it was a fascinating event, and you know, it as you say, it's very interesting to see which suppliers have the right idea and which suppliers are trying to make the right idea. And you know, some of them have a very interesting opinion on what they think education should have.
Well, absolutely. And I went along to an event earlier this week that was in the same location, but was very different, and it was called Learning Without Frontiers. Now, there were a bunch of pods and talks and stuff happening here, and the idea was just thinking towards the future. So whereas Bet's a lot more about the present and what's possible and what people could get, Learning Without Frontiers is much more about, hey, this is the future. This is what might happen. This is how it all could be. It could really be a wonderful world, and lots of thought leaders doing some great talks and keynotes. But one of the great things were there were a bunch of pods, and I went and had a look around. There was a Lego pod, really? And they just had a table full of Lego, and it was all about how you can build stuff and learn from it. Great kind of people in there talking about how using Lego actually builds your logic skills, which helps inspire a new generation of coders, which is such a great That's way awesome. Of thinking about it. I love Lego. The National Museum of Computing were there. They had a pod full of working old computers. Now, me being a bit of a retrophile, I spent like half an hour in there. I sat down at a BBC Micro with the same book that I used to learn BASIC on a BBC Micro back in the day, and I just sat there and wrote a simple program. Nice. It was fantastic. I twitpicked a little bit of that as well. It was brilliant.
Was it 10 print hello 20 go to 10?
No, not quite. It's so nice to see those guys there. The National Museum of Computing is based in Bletchley Park, and it's well worth a visit if you're going there as well.
Oh, that sounds pretty cool.
But the very very coolest thing that was there, there were a group of young hackers there that had been at the Young Rewired State event in the summer last year, and talked about that before. So there are a group of young people there that were just sat there in a pod hacking away at some various things, and on the end of the second day today, they presented what they'd done to everyone. And there's some really cool ideas and some really interesting projects, but I think the fact that you've got young people going along to these events that are coding and showing that people are passionate and it was just fantastic to see. And so, big shout out to certainly looking at the Twitter, Dylan, who just tweeted about LWF12 being win. He was one of the geeks there. So was Kevin, who I think is listening to. Just fantastic to see those people there as well.
You're listening to the Geekly Chronicles.
We should now have Rob Hawkes on the line. Hello, Rob.
Hi, how you doing?
Fantastic, it works. I'm happy. I'm happy that Skype is on our side this evening. How are you?
Not bad, thank you. Not bad. Thanks for inviting me on.
Oh, yeah, you're very welcome.
It's great to have you here.
Absolutely. So, Rob, why don't you start just by telling us who you are and what you do?
Sure, okay. So, probably gathered, I'm Rob Hawkes. I work for Mozilla as a technical evangelist. I've been here for 7 months now. Came to Mozilla straight after university, studied interactive media production at Bournemouth Uni. Should probably say what a technical evangelist does. I often have to ask that question myself.
Oh, don't give away our secrets.
Yeah. Basically, it's just about engaging with developers. For me particularly, it's about sort of the interface between Mozilla and the developer community. So making sure that we're talking about the technologies that Mozilla are working on, HTML5, JavaScript, things like that. It's less about promoting Mozilla technologies and more about just talking about web technologies in general. Now, that doesn't mean that that's what technical evangelists do in every company, but for Mozilla, that's kind of the gist of what we do. So that's through public speaking and blog posts and just generally sort of being around on the internet and involved in the community. The backstory really is came out of university straight into the job. And the reason why that happened so sort of nicely was I've sort of been working with the web for about over half my life now, since I was 12. So I've sort of always been hacking around with things like PHP and HTML and JavaScript and all that kind of stuff. And it all sort of culminated in the last few years with me getting involved in HTML5 Canvas. And basically resulted in one day, I remember it well, September the 7th, last 2 years ago actually, just decided to recreate this Google Bulls doodle in HTML Canvas because people were saying it was HTML5. It wasn't. I was getting frustrated and decided, let's show the world what HTML5 could do. It just sort of blew up really. And from there, it's just been a bit of a roller coaster ride. That's sort of the backstory, I think.
Very cool. So playing with the web since you were 12, what were some of your early creations, if you can share? I mean, colleague of mine, Martin Beebe, always talks about the fact that his first thing that he created was a text messaging service that he kind of stole from HMV. And I'm sure he can tell that story better than me. But were there any particular things you worked on when you were 12, or was it just kind of dabbling?
When I literally just started, it was mainly dabbling and basically just getting excited in the fact that I could create something and have it on the web and anyone in the world could see it. If people remember it, I used to have a thing called a Digimon, which was basically a Tamagotchi that battled with other people.
Yeah.
And I thought it'd be a great idea to make a website to show people how to cheat with it. So I was using GeoCities at the time.
First website was on GeoCities.
I had 100 websites on GeoCities. I can remember them all well.
It was great, and you get the BraveNet guest books and counters and all that kind of stuff. It was good times.
BraveNet, good lord.
Yeah, back in the day.
So yeah, young developers nowadays, they just don't know.
the stuff we went through.
Oh, exactly. It's easy now. But it was good fun, and I think what really got me involved in the web was once I realized that I wasn't just using a sort of what you see is what you get tool. I could actually sort of edit some this code stuff, which I didn't know what it was at the time. And things changed, and it was like a new world. I could actually divert from what GeoCities was forcing upon me, and I could do whatever I wanted. And it was a really good experience. And from there, it sort of just blossomed. And I think that's the same for any developer.
Yeah, I mean, certainly when I started out, I'd done stuff in BASIC, and I tried a bit of Windows programming using Delphi, kind of going back that quite a way. I mean, I'd done a bit of command line-y stuff and Pascal and that, and I was trying to use Delphi. Yeah. And then the web came along, and I got a PC that was connected to the internet for the first time. And sure, I'd played around with things like Front Page and that kind of thing. But then when I started actually looking at HTML, and there was some debate over whether HTML was going to be the future, whether it was going to be something else entirely. Everyone thought, hey, you know, there are other things that will take over from HTML, not realizing, of course, that HTML 4 and 5 would come along and add a lot of functionality. But I just played around with it, and it was so simple to do really great stuff. Mm. And then you look at other languages now that are just, they take HTML simplicity and try and learn from that, which I think is fantastic as well.
Yeah, I definitely think that's part of its magic, is it's just so easy to use, and it really, there honestly isn't that much to it. When I was 12, I bought a book on HTML4, and I literally learned it in a week, and I was done. I was really happy. I could do anything. I could make bold text. I could make italic text. I could do anything. It's might look scary.
Bold
when you start,
text, but italic text. Everything.
Well, that's pretty much all.
That's all you've got. Bold text or italic text.
I was happy. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Lists as well. Yeah.
Scrolling marquees. That was everything you could do in HTML3 and HTML4.
I am every developer's not worst nightmare, because I used to use frames and tables
I made a website using frames once, and then realized that it kind of worked. But I was on AOL at home, and this was at the time where AOL had its own browser.
Gosh,
and
yes, yeah.
You couldn't just use things like Internet Explorer or Firefox or anything like that with it. I remember I went to school and they had IE4 or something like that on a Windows 98 machine. And I looked at it in that, and it looked nothing like it did on mine. And I thought, no wonder nobody visits this website. And so that was my first lesson in interop on websites. I didn't quite know what the phrase graceful degradation meant at that point, but
yeah. Oh, it's an interesting point, actually, because I mean, when I think back to those sorts of times, and as I sort of grew up, it was so difficult to, there were so many problems and things you had to work around, and sort of interoperability sort of issues of CSS and what have you. And now, yes, okay, there's similar, but it's really not the same. It seems to be a much better situation now in general.
Well, absolutely. And I look at kind of modern day websites, and there are still a few websites up on the internet that haven't changed since 1996. The Space Jam website from Warner Brothers is one of them.
Oh, yeah.
Search for that, and there is an original HTML3/4 images and frames, and it's horrible, but it's perfectly preserved.
Brilliant.
And it works in IE6 as well, which is a mark of how old it is.
Wow.
And you compare that to modern websites. The whole talk around web standards is quite interesting because whenever you talk to anyone about the web or go to a web conference now, it's standards, and everyone is talking about standards and making sure that everything works everywhere. And that's obviously very important. But like you mentioned, Rob, the situation has changed. It's come a long way. So how do you feel about where we are with web standards? Do you think we're heading in the right direction?
Yeah, I mean, in general, yes. I think we've definitely come a long way. In my limited experience, I mean, I've not been around for as long as some people in the web, but I've definitely noticed an improvement. And I wouldn't say it sort of just occurred randomly. There was a specific point in time where, now the web's a really good place. It just sort of, I gradually realized that developing on the web was becoming much easier because things I wanted to use were supported across browser effectively. And I think I probably noticed that most recently with things like the Canvas, HTML5 Canvas element and the related JavaScript APIs. And when I realized how well that was supported and as that went on sort of in the future, I think I just sort of had this funny feeling where I was like, hang on, it's really not that difficult anymore to use these technologies. It's not a fight. It's sort of just you just need to be sure about what you're developing for.
Can you tell us a little bit about Canvas briefly? Because I think there are probably some people listening in that are not entirely sure what Canvas is.
Yeah, sure. So the Canvas API is sort of my speciality, is what I do. And basically, it's a 2D bitmap drawing system. And it has a HTML5 element, or for a sort of technically correct term, it's a HTML element. And what that is it's basically just a window. It doesn't do anything. And then you use JavaScript to draw through that window and effectively change pixels on this canvas. The best way to look at it is like Microsoft Paint back in the old days, or an Etch-a-Sketch, because the Etch-a-Sketch idea is quite an interesting one, because if you want to erase anything on the canvas, you have to wipe it clean completely and start again. So it's a very basic tool, but it really opens up the a new world within browsers, which is sort of custom graphics that aren't, or images that you've already created in a very, very easy to use API.
That's really cool. And one of the really powerful things about the way that web is going, and people talk about HTML and HTML5. And I've unfortunately heard people refer to the HTML5 programming language, which shows a slight lack of understanding, I suppose. But really, this idea that actually HTML is an evolving thing. It's much like any other piece of technology. New bits are being added to it and improved upon all the time. The great thing about HTML5 is that it does so much stuff that you used to need plugins for. You know, I have a personal opinion about plugins and how much they should go home and die. But I think that the exciting thing to many people about HTML5 is that it'll run in a web browser without needing plugins, which is faster, and it can do so much. And certainly, a lot of people are now switching to HTML5 players for things and really nice looking HTML5 websites. We shall ask some of these questions that are coming in shortly. But what do you think? So in your opinion, what does the web need more of? And what does the web definitely need less of? And less trollolol and rickrolling is not the answer, because the web clearly needs more of that.
The more of one's pretty easy to answer. I think we've got plenty of sort of experiments with these technologies that are coming out. So these HTML5 and JavaScript and what have you. Which is great, and we definitely need more of those in general. But I think what we really need more of is sort of real-world examples of these technologies in use. So aside from the sort of cool marketing demos and all those kinds of things, I think we need to really have a look at how these technologies are being used in production environments, on real websites, in real situations that aren't sort of a one-hit wonder kind of thing. I think there's quite a few people that feel that way. And I think that's needed. It's definitely happening, but I think we need to focus on that more to sort of legitimize the technology and sort of turn it away from just being a cool buzzword that people use to create something fun and funky that sort of has a limited sort of lifespan, and it, to actually making HTML5 something that's a real sort of stack of technologies that people can use in production environments to actually push the web forward. So that's definitely one of the things that I think we need. And the other one is I feel very strongly that we need much more. We've got so many young people in this industry, and we need more of those young people sort of making their voices heard and being part of the community. And whether that's through like hacking, getting involved in events, experimenting with the web technologies that they're learning about and hearing about. And it's the only way that me personally, that's how I progressed as a developer, and how I got to where I am today is just having fun with the web and creating things that I personally enjoyed and other people sort of learning from that at the same time. And I think young people, if we can get more young people to do that, I think the future of the web is going to be a much, much better place.
Cool. So what do you think the web needs less of then?
Yeah, less of. So this is a much harder one. An easy one really is we definitely need less, within the web industry at least, we definitely need a lot less debates about how to use technical terms. So whether we need to use HTML5 to refer to everything, or whether we refer to it as HTML5, JavaScript, CSS3, web fonts, all this kind of stuff. It definitely matters, but I think we are wasting our time worrying about that when we could be concentrating on much better things. But aside from that, I'm not really sure. I mean, we perhaps need less of a particular example is when people are using these new cool technologies, there's a lot of misunderstanding about which browsers support what, and perhaps an element of laziness in some projects where, particularly in gaming at the moment, HTML5 gaming, there's a lot of sort of games that say work best in Chrome or something like that. And I think we need less of that, and we need to try as hard as we can to be cross-browser compatible. And not sort of hark back to the early days of the web where it was a sort of per browser world. Like you were saying with the AOL and the IE thing, it just didn't look the same. Go on.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, this reminds me of an experience I had. It was a few years ago now, but I was browsing to a website and somebody had sent me a link to something. And I was using IE to open it, and it came up saying, sorry, use a good browser. Here's a link to download Firefox and Chrome. And while not every message like that is quite so blunt, right. And yes, I'll be the first to admit that other browsers may do things that other browsers don't, putting it as diplomatically as I can there. and I wasn't using IE6, I have to say. This thing that people don't get, this whole idea of graceful degradation, and maybe a particular browser doesn't support the exact thing you're trying to do, but
right.
I agree that the web needs less only works in Chrome or only works in this browser or works better in that browser, and yeah. more trying to provide a great experience for users of the web. At the end of the day, if you want to make a website that is a soapbox about what browser you should use, create that and not an app that does that as well.
Right. Yeah, I think you sort of hit the nail on the head, really. If it's a technology that is only supported in one particular browser, it's a very, you don't have much choice. And to be fair, like we have websites that have only best viewed in Firefox. So although I work for Mozilla, the problem's everywhere. It's for every browser. And I think it's partly an educational thing. People just not knowing that technologies are as well supported as they are, and partly just like I said, it's sometimes just laziness or a decision that's been made because it's easier. I don't know.
Well, and I think sometimes it can be a bit political as well. I mean, sure. The two recent kind of HTML5 game examples that stand out for me is Angry Birds and Cut the Rope. Fantastic apps. Angry Birds came out that was a this works on Chrome, and it was a big thing pushed by Google. And then recently, very similarly, with Cut the Rope and Internet Explorer 9. Cut the Rope works great in any HTML5 browser, but of course it was a thing that was co-done with Microsoft, and so there was that IE message, and similarly with Angry Birds and being co-done with Google. So I think it can be almost a look at what our browser can do from some companies as well. But, you know, that's, I suppose, marketing people will do what marketing people do.
Right. And it's a slightly different use case that, I mean, it's not so bad if it's a promotional tool, so long as it still works in the other browser. Whereas, so we've Cut the Rope, that was, I think it was a little bit more acceptable for Cut the Rope to provide IE-only levels when the entire game actually did work in most browsers. Whereas, particularly a recent version of Angry Birds released in the last couple of days, I think, is actually you can only play it in Chrome. That's the wrong situation.
Yeah, we need to stop user agent sniffing, I think,
right.
that point there. So I'm going to take a break now and ask you a few questions from Twitter, if that's okay. Just scrolling through here. There are some quite interesting ones. I'm just going to check the name here. Connor says, is Rob worried about Google Chrome's ever-growing usage? In fact, the size of Google as a whole. And now a couple of other people have come back here, and Helena said, who isn't? I'm worrying about the possibility of us eating Google food and sleeping in Google beds, which is quite an interesting one. But Connor's question was, are you worried about Google's browser share?
Personally, no. And I think Mozilla as a whole aren't that concerned either. I mean, it's something we need to be aware of, but the whole fact that there's sort of browser competition can only be good for the web. It's going to stop people getting lazy with their sort of browsers. It's going to encourage innovation. But aside from that, I think it's important to say, like, particularly from a Mozilla point of view, like, we are partially funded by Google, and it's the fact that Google have a browser that is Chrome doesn't necessarily mean that we must beat them or Microsoft must beat them. Whoever's best and has the most share isn't necessarily a bad thing. What's most important is whether the person who has the most share and all the other browsers on that hand actually do good for the web. So that is support the web standards, they abide by sort of the guidelines, they don't sort of go away on their own and create their own technologies and sort of shun the ones that the rest of the browsers are supporting. And I don't think that's the case. There are situations where it's a little bit iffy, but I mean, on the whole, we're in a really good place. So I'm not too fussed personally about who's on top, whether that's Firefox, Chrome, Opera, Microsoft. It doesn't really matter, so long as they're doing the right thing.
Yeah, and I think the point about competition is really valid. I mean, there's the whole thing around Internet Explorer 6 kind of becoming this almost cancer on the internet because there was no version for a long time, and suddenly, I mean, it's still around today. I mean, it's still companies are using it, and people are still finding that that's their only experience of the web. So competition in any aspect of business, but particularly on the web, I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. It keeps people good and true and keeps innovation moving forwards, and you don't get that proliferation of nothing, you know, and proprietary technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the healthy web competition over the past few years has played a huge role in helping the entire web move forward. That leads quite nicely onto a question from Tim. He says, what upcoming features being developed for HTML are you most excited about? Can think of a few developing from vendors. So what are you most excited about upcoming in HTML?
I'm going to include JavaScript in that. So I'm mostly excited about a lot of the gaming related sort of technologies that are coming out. So things like gamepad support. So you can now plug in an Xbox controller or a PS3 controller or any USB controller and use it in the browser for games just by using a little bit of JavaScript. So that's pretty cool. Looking forward to that. And that's currently out in Chrome and Firefox development versions. I'm also looking forward to some of the other JavaScript APIs that sort of break away from the web being seen as something that you type in an address and you just sort of view a website as a website. So things like full screen APIs, which allow you to turn any element of a website into a full screen element. So it goes outside of the browser and it takes your entire computer screen. It creates, particularly for games or video or images, can create a much more immersive environment. But also the sort of movement with web apps as well. I think that's going to be one of the most exciting things. And I know at Mozilla we're working on something where you can basically install a web app as any website or a game or whatever as a what's called a web app, which will run, say, on your dock on the Mac. And it will load, but it won't look like a website. It will just look like a normal application. Apart from it's still just a normal website behind the scenes. It's just HTML, JavaScript, and CSS.
And how do you feel? I mean, that I guess leads quite nicely onto an interesting question. While there's obviously lots more news to come in the future about the next iteration, the next incarnation of Windows. So far within the developer preview and information that's been announced, there's been a lot of talk of being able to create full screen Windows applications that make use of HTML5, CSS, and JavaScript. And certainly I've seen some demos and examples of websites and web apps that work with very little alteration in that kind of setting as well. Do you think that's the right sort of direction to be moving in? To have that kind of support in a desktop stroke laptop, whatever OS as well. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's a difficult one because, at the end of the day, the results are the same. What's difficult is the way it's implemented. And I think I'm a little concerned with whoever does it, whether it's, whoever. But I mean, what I mean is if it's implemented directly into the operating system, it's not necessarily open, which is kind of what the web is about. So it becomes sort of the boundaries of what's right and wrong for the web sort of get blurred a little bit. In general, I think if people can sort of turn websites into a little bit more of an immersive experience, an application, a game or what have you, and break away from that concept of a website in a browser, however that's done right now, I'm not massively fussed. I think in the future, as standards do, I think we can iron out the kinks as we go along.
So it's important to be providing that experience, but let's make sure we keep it nice and open.
Yeah, effectively.
So one last question that we've had through that I'm going to ask tonight. This is from Benedict. How do you think the open source movement will evolve over the coming years? I suppose, how do you feel about the open source movement?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think it's a great movement. It's coming on sort of leaps and bounds in my personal experience. I obviously pretty much learn everything that I know through sort of open source projects and technologies, and it's sort of the only way young developers can get into the web, through using things like WordPress and what have you. With like projects like GitHub, where people can now share their code very easily and collaborate and comment on, I think it's just going to continue progressing. It's going to become easier to create these kinds of projects and to get involved in them. Through my experience so far with Mozilla, I can see there's a thriving community based around this kind of development, and I can't see it slowing down. Really, I think it's just going to sort of keep going. And sort of related to the previous question, I think this is why it's important to make sure what we do related to the web stays open, so everyone can be involved and have their say.
Yeah, and that's a brilliant message, I think. And it's important, again, there are so many kind of myths about what open source is and what it means. Open source doesn't refer to a particular language or a particular technology. It's this principle of writing and contributing and sharing and keeping things open. And you know, there is so much stuff that so many communities do that are open source, and that's fantastic. And nobody should feel like they have to walk down a certain path or use a certain technology or a certain language or whatever to do something and contribute to open source projects. It's something that people just need to do. It's such a fantastic way of working, and it helps make kind of everything in technology better, certainly from a developing new ideas and new experiences point of view.
And I think it's important that, I think this is another thing that may sort of happen more in the future regarding open source, is I think people will realize that being open source doesn't necessarily mean you have to, your product has to be free. You can make money from open source projects. You can still sort of do good for the web and still earn a living.
Absolutely. I think that's very important. That is such an important thing to remember, is that open source and open source software does not mean free. And mm-hmm. you can still make your way in the world, make your living contributing to open source projects. And that doesn't just mean that people donate, but there is no reason why you can't create a paid for piece of software that is open source. And WordPress is a great example. While WordPress itself is free, mm-hmm. if you were to have something that was like WordPress but paid for, but still has that open source community when it comes to the plugins and the themes and that kind of thing, that mm-hmm. that is still open source, but very much something that is an earner. Mm. So I think that's a really, really important point. And I hope that many people feel encouraged to get on board with open sourcing the things that they're doing.
Definitely.
So Rob, just before we say goodbye, do you have anything to say to the community? Anything that that young web developers, aspiring web developers, or just people interested in the web and what it can do should hear?
So I suppose, I think if I was talking to myself when I was, say, 12 or 15 or whatever, I think what I would tell myself is sort of have confidence in what you're doing and keep at it. I think that's the main thing. Sort of don't despair that you might not be that great at what you do right now, or that someone else is immensely better than you, because it doesn't matter how good you are, someone's always going to be better than you. And I think the other thing is just things take time. So just be patient, have some, as long as you've got the passion and the perseverance, you'll be able to achieve what you want. And don't be afraid to change your direction if you're not happy with what you're doing. I think that's probably the biggest lesson I learned in my life. I did go to university once before, and it was for something that I didn't actually enjoy that much. And once I realized that, I was a much happier person, and I focused on earning a living from playing with web technologies. So I think out of all of them, I think that's the main one, is just make sure you do what you love, and just try and work out how to make money out of that, a living, not just like profit, tons of profit.
Yeah, I was having just the same conversation yesterday with a group of people who have done that. It's so amazing to look at people who are doing things that they love and are making a living from it. And it's really not too difficult to do. You're doing it, we're doing it, and anyone listening to the show can do that as well.
Yeah, it just takes time. I mean, I've been doing this for 13 years now. It's not something that happened overnight because I made a couple of Google bulls sort of move around. There's a lot of time and effort and sort of blood, sweat and tears that went into where I am today. And you just need to put that time in, and eventually it will pay off.
Absolutely. And you've also made an incredibly addictive multiplayer online game too, called Rockets.
Yeah.
Did I say that right?
Yes, you did. Yeah.
Thanks very much for coming on the show, Rob, and talking to us about the web, your journey, the things that you've done, answering a few of our listeners' questions. Would you like to give your website a plug before we say goodbye?
Yeah, sure. So basically, if you want to sort of keep up to date with anything that I'm up to or what I'm doing at Mozilla or Rawkets, if you want, just go to my website, which is Rawks. So that's rawkes.com, and you can basically find out everything you want. And just follow me on Twitter and sort of listen to what I'm talking about and get in touch. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Rob, for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. And you can follow Rob Hawks on Twitter as well. And I'm sure I'll be happy to answer any of your questions a bit later on too.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Thanks, Rob.
So that's it. The web, open source, all of that stuff, James. Such a fantastic topic. Such a great thing to talk about. And really, really inspiring stuff there from Rob.
Absolutely. I mean, I look back at sort of my experience on the web and, you know, as you say, GeoCities and all that sort of brings it all back. And you look at what we're doing now and kind of where that's going, and I think it's all good. And
I was browsing the web the other day, and I came across a website, someone that, and I love it when people do this, being the retrophile that I am, still had all of the articles and things that he'd made like back in 97, 98 on the web as well, all in their original folders, so all of the old links still worked. Mm. And it was fantastic to read through some of that stuff. And it was a web developer who'd been blogging since 1996 about the web and how it was evolving. And it was fascinating to read through some of that stuff. But it looked old and it looked dated, and I'm so glad that the web has come on leaps and bounds
well,
since
you
then.
You say that, but I think one of the most fantastic services that they have on the internet, and I pray that it will exist in some form or another forever, because I think it's necessary, is the Wayback Machine. You know, we talk about how much the web has changed and how much websites have changed, and you mentioned that the Space Jam website still looks as it did from 1996. But
we need more
websites
like that.
You know, just as
but the Wayback Machine needs to work better.
Well,
that's
yeah,
my
but
thing.
You know, just as old file formats are now, you know, being there are no longer devices like Laserdisc. You know, how nobody's going to be able to open things off a Laserdisc in a few years.
Nor should they.
No, but the point is, in 20 years' time, or even in 2 years' time, because it's such a fast-moving landscape, I think there needs to be that kind of preservation.
So I still have all of the original games and applications I wrote on a 5.5-inch floppy disk. And I've got a disk drive, but I don't have a machine currently to use it in. And I wish I did. So if anyone listening has a machine I can look at my old applications in, please let me know and I will buy you much coffee and cake to come and take my files off. But yeah, we've had a few more great tweets there. We've had Dean say that he uses Internet Explorer and Safari, the two defaults, and things work perfectly well. I see no difference. That's the way the web should be. I like that. We've had Milo say, I particularly like the model for games releasing. The engine is open source, but keeping the assets closed. So that's a great mix of open and closed source, all within the kind of similar projects. And Tim has said that Geekly has just reminded me of the disappointment of Space Jam.
Hey, Space Jam was awesome.
I did not like it.
Well, we're going to have to agree to disagree with that.
You're listening to the Geekly Chronicles with Ben and James. They're never going to give you up.
Lots and lots of opinion coming through on the hashtag and on the Twitter account around the file sharing, SOPA, etc. So Tim here says the arrest and closing of Mega Upload is also reasonable in my opinion. They made a lot of money out of a business based on piracy. Certainly an interesting view.
The thing is, there are lots of services that you could argue make money out of piracy. I mean, you know, I suppose it depends on from which side of the argument you're coming. You could argue perfectly legitimately, I suppose, that on the one hand, video sharing websites, the likes of YouTube, could potentially be branded the same way. In fact, I think that's one of the defences that Mega Upload's team are using, is that people upload copyrighted content to YouTube all the time, and while YouTube do their best to take it down, it's still there, and you know, Mega Upload are no different. They just happen to be serving a different kind of media.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's another really interesting there are lots of really interesting apparently had a car with the number plate God. I think that says a lot about the man. As Helena says here, if you're going to run a blatantly copyright infringing business, don't go buying a Rolls Royce Phantom with the license plate God, which is I suppose a fair point. And we've got people offering to come on and talk about SOPA and Piper by Skyping in. We are Ask Geekly on Skype. We will say hi on IM there. And if you've got something awesome to contribute, there is no reason why you can't come on and say hello.
Although somebody has just said that you should change your surname to Nyan. And, of course, you would be Ben Nyan. Thank you, Lewis, for that suggestion.
Nyan. I could also just be Ben Nyanny because I am Ben Nyanny. It could work quite well. Or I could just change a part of my name to Nyan, so I can go and Ben Nunny. Nyan's my middle name. So there's been so much in the news about various different laws, various different laws that have been trying to pass as SOPA and Piper, obviously in the US. ACTA, which is more in the EU.
Well, of course, we had that blackout day where a lot of very popular websites, Wikipedia being one of them, decided that in protest to this, to show that they absolutely disagreed with SOPA's principles, they would deny access to their English language website.
Well, unless you knew just to modify the JavaScript header on there. But yeah, I mean, it's absolutely... It absolutely made people that use the internet stop and notice and see what was going on. The hashtag facts without Wikipedia popped up, and I tweeted something about the beginnings of the internet on that. It had over 700 retweets. I mean, this is really unprecedented for me. That was quite a big thing. So lots of people were paying attention, and I was seeing some very interesting tweets. I follow a few actors and stuff like that on Twitter, and I saw an actor tweet saying... that awkward moment where you work in the film industry, but you're also a geek and don't support SOPA.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting how so many people are kind of seeing this divide. And George said Facebook and Twitter should have gone down as well. It would have made more of an impact to people. Well, yes and no, I suppose.
That's an interesting point. I mean, I did think about that. And Twitter were courted. They were asked if they could... take part in this blackout, and obviously, you know, they didn't. And I think, you know, blacking out your service, you know, is akin to going on a strike in a physical sense. There are lots of debates to be had around the effectiveness of that. I think, you know, if you're a well-educated person, you can make your own opinion about how you feel about SOPA and its effects. And I think celebrities and people caught up in that kind of weird loyalty divide between being in an industry that inherently needs to support it, but being a person that's a part of that, that actually, when you read the facts, you don't. So I don't know. I don't necessarily agree that the blackout was a positive thing. I think it was a very visible thing, but to be honest, it just made me sick of hearing about Encarta, because the day was just rife with people going, I've got my Encarta 95 CD here. I'm thinking, good for you. I haven't used Encarta since
95.
But it just seemed to be, that was the, I haven't heard that word for years, and on the blackout day, it was everywhere.
And so we've had Conair say, my brother said, a company called SOPA hacked Wikipedia and took them down all day. So maybe some people didn't quite get the reason behind it. But then Dan says the blackout day was great. I had to explain to so many people what SOPA and Piper was. So I suppose it was a good opportunity to get people talking about it. Not everyone maybe understood from the start what was going on there. And I don't necessarily know how widely it was reported. And what the kind of quality of reporting was, because you would imagine that with news outlets having to stay reasonably impartial.
Well, and yes, it's. I think there's a lot of misinformation around about what it is, what it isn't, the effects it could have. There's loads of speculation about, you know, the fact that if the bill were passed and you were to do these things, then XYZ would be illegal under SOPA and so on and so forth. And I think that's a lot of that is probably a little bit of scaremongering, but I've no doubt that it's probably in some way true. But reporting on it has been difficult, and to find a reliable, non-biased source has proved challenging.
Exactly. And an absolutely great comment here from John Hughes, saying the Wikipedia blackout was a little bit of a feeble attempt, in his opinion. It wasn't maybe the best thing that they could have done. But let's not forget the Oatmeal's amazing SOPA protest gift.
Yes.
And it's important to note that so many smaller sites were also blacking out for the day. Not that the Oatmeal's massively small, lots of visitors every day. But they did an animated gift that was very satirical. And I think that certainly the...
Well, satirical and simple. I understood more about SOPA watching that for a minute than I think I'd read in the run-up to that day. I think it was brilliant.
Well, it makes me think back to when the elections were happening a couple of years ago in the UK, and there was a great online video about it was done using cats, and everyone likes videos of cats on the internet, right?
You can't be allergic to a cat on the internet.
No, this is true. You can't be allergic to cuteness of the cats on the internet either. And it was explaining the election and what voting for different parties would mean in terms of people and seats, and also around kind of first past the post and how all of that worked. And it was really good to see people trying to explain it to other people in their own way.
Well, yeah, you have to break it down. I mean, it's all well and good posting up lots of jargon-filled, lengthy news articles, but at the end of the day, seeing something like the oatmeal is very, very visual, very, very simple. This is what would happen if this happened. That works for me. I'm quite a simple person like that. I like to see things put very simply. So,
absolutely. The layman's terms are great for so many reasons. Tom says the best thing about the blackout day was the really creative and cool blackout pages.
That's, yes.
Highlighting creativity on the web there. And Connor says, are the oatmeal koalas for the win?
Absolutely.
But certainly not going to discuss what they were doing on there. Canary again says, what did annoy me was, despite being against it, Facebook did a little more than Mark Zuckerberg's post challenging it. And
well, Amir points out very rightly that actually Encarta is better because there's no mention of Justin Bieber in Encarta.
That's very, very true. That was before Bieber's time.
Probably literally. I mean, how old is he?
18.
Is he? I didn't even think
something
he was that
like
old.
That. Yeah.
Too young.
Yes. And so, yeah, and George raises a good point. And there was a whole website dedicated to showing tweets of people that were doing this. You still have the idiots complaining about Wikipedia being down and how it's wrong that Wikipedia was down. And they didn't care about what SOPA was. And it's interesting that there were just a whole bunch of internet users that didn't care. Well, I'm sure they'd miss it if it was gone, but they don't care that it's under threat.
This is the thing that, you know, I think in many areas, not just in the SOPA thing, but you have the very vocal, somewhat educated in the matter minority who do grab the headlines, who do tweet, who do post, who do interview very vocally about the matter. And then you have the vast majority of people who live in complete blissful ignorance. They just get their stuff from Wikipedia, or, you know, in the case of O2 recently, they browse the internet on their mobile phone. They don't really care that their mobile number's being shared, or that secretly the US government's going to pass a bill that means that this kind of thing could go. Like, to them, it's just a blissfully ignorant existence. And one day it'll go, and they'll wonder why, but they have no idea. And so when they see things like Wikipedia being blacked out for the day or whatever, I think it brings me back to an example I used to get almost every single time the internet went down. So in a previous job, I worked in a school and looked after a network, and they'd fire up the internet, as they called it, and if the school's website was down for any reason, it would give a page cannot be displayed error. To them, the whole world, the internet was down. They had no understanding of what the problem was.
Well, and this kind of goes back to something Rob was talking about before as well, and things have changed. The internet is not just for geeks anymore. It's not just techie people that make use of the internet, websites and web services, that kind of thing. And when you've got something that the technical community in the first instance cares a lot about because they know about it, how do you get that message out to all of those people that don't care about how it works? They just care that it works. We spend so much time focusing on making fantastic experiences for people to use connected online. And how do they find out that the internet's under threat? The kind of the things that they use are under threat.
But how do you get that message across to any of the majority of users of a thing? You could apply it to anything. A car. Most people who drive a car don't care how it works, just that it does. How do you educate them that actually they need to pay a bit of attention? That, you know, if they don't, you know, pay attention and listen and perhaps sometimes nurture and do a bit of work, otherwise one day that thing they've come to rely on is going to go away. I mean, every year Wikipedia puts up its pleas for funding and people ignore it. And it's always this scramble at the last minute. Will they get enough money to last for another year? And one day they won't hit that target, and all of those ignorant people it's just gonna disappear, and they'll wonder what happened because they weren't. You know, how do we get that message out there in a way that's understood?
And there was an interesting opinion piece that I read that said SOPA should have passed because then people would have cared, and then people would have been up in arms. And at that point, people would start caring because the things that they really needed and they wanted to use would stop working and stop being there. And I think that you're always going to get that level of apathy with people until something bad has happened. They won't take action, that like the rest of the internet was trying to do by taking preventative action. They'll only be reactive, not proactive in doing that. And that was a really interesting article to read. While I don't necessarily agree that it should have, it's certainly interesting to think about, well, it maybe is it going to take something big, something huge, some kind of massive meltdown to actually get the rest of the world to care?
I think the penalisation for any of these things needs to be proportional to the crime committed as well. So, you know, you talk about the fact that, you know, this guy Kim.com could have got all of these years in prison, and that's less time than he would have got for murder. You know, you look at the London riots, for example. There was those kids that, you know, elicited a riot on Facebook, and they've got 4 years in prison, and yet somebody could do something far worse relatively and, you know, not get any
time, far less time
at all. And I think it's fine to have safeguards and laws and rules around copyright. I think, you know, we are decades away from a world where copyright no longer is a problem. But I think the punishments have to be proportionate to the crime. And putting somebody behind bars for 20 years or, you know, taking down an entire website, which does have, let's face it, a legitimate purpose. I mean, file sharing in general is a legitimate exercise. It's just what you share on it is necessarily, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And I have used torrents to send people stuff that I have created if I want to do it in a mass way. But,
you know, if you get caught breaking the rules, then you should get the slap on the wrist or the time in prison or the fine or the community service, whatever is, you know, relative to your crime. But just arbitrarily branding everyone as this, you know,
horrible pirate,
exactly, is wrong.
Well, and I think it's just a fundamental misunderstanding by the people that create these laws as to what's gonna go on.
Exactly. You know, I could come up with analogies all evening.
Absolutely. So Alex says, knowing things about the web used to be the telltale sign of a geek. Now, if you don't know about the web, you're an outsider. Very true, really. I mean, it's the internet has become this pervasive thing that we all use almost all of the time for things. Certainly, the times I'm not online are the times I'm walking to other places where I'm going to be online for something. The web is very much a thing that has invaded everyone's lives. For better or for worse, that's where we are. That's how we live. We are connected. We are jacked into this big internet machine. Lots of very interesting comments. And Andrew points out that ACTA has now been signed by the UK, US and Europe, which is worse than SOPA. So it's definitely worth looking online about what that means and what that does.
Well, there's a case going on at the moment, and I it's just come to my mind, so I haven't actually got the full details. But I remember now it's looking to be illegal to recreate a photo. So before, you know, if you copied a photo, as in literally facsimile copied a photo, that was breaking copyright law because that photo and the composition of it and everything in it, that was a work of art. Now they're saying that potentially, you know, all of those millions of people, you know, who go to Abbey Road every year and recreate that famous Beatles album cover, or, you know, people that recreate the tennis girl shot from, you know, that famous poster, you know, suddenly these people who are kind of emulating, recreating those moments, they will now be deemed as breaking copyright law and will be subject to, you know, punishment by law. And that's a really dangerous thing, because suddenly you're potentially saying that everything you see, if somebody's taken a picture of it, now nobody else can ever take a picture of it.
That's crazy. Nobody would ever be able to kiss the Blarney Stone again because someone once has already taken a photo of someone doing it.
Well, it would be an end to photo tourism, because suddenly
it would be an end to photo sharing on Facebook.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's even interesting looking at it on the music point of view. And of course, a lot of these things originated in the music industry. We play commercial music on this live show, and we pay for a license to do that. And the money for that license, and it's all worked out on the number of songs you play and how often you play it, how many people hear it, that kind of thing. That money goes to the artists and to various other things, however right or wrong that is. But there used to be another license that you'd have to get for mechanical copyright protection. And that was a fee that you had to pay if you wanted to, if you bought a song on CD, but I wanted to play it out through our computerized playout system, the ripping of that CD, even though I'd bought it onto my computer, was illegal unless I owned an MCPS license. And technically, it used to be illegal at home to do that as well. But that law was dropped a little while ago.
We still pay that license. That's still a requirement. We still have to have that mechanical license fee, even in this digital day and age. In order to store the music we play, we have to have a license for it.
Which seems rather odd. And that's not a license fee that's going to the artist. And the artist should be paid for their work, but that doesn't seem necessarily like the most productive use of funds.
Well, it's just a minefield, and I can understand that there are probably some very well-intentioned people who want to ensure that creative types get rewarded for their work and don't have their work copied. It's just unfortunate that there are probably some other types of people who seize upon the law and use it to their advantage to ensure that people are exploited, I suppose, in terms of protecting copyright and IP.
And some interesting comments here. Dan says, so does that mean I'm breaking the law for doing GCSE art where I redraw artists' work?
In theory, it might. Yeah, it may well do.
You'll have to ask your teacher about how ACTA will affect your grades. But it's a very, very serious point and a very real issue, and we should absolutely look at everything that we're doing. And Elena says, in all honesty, so long as things cost money, piracy will exist, either in the form of people uploading and downloading for free or selling copied DVDs for a profit. It still makes that illegal. Milo says there's DRM everywhere, which hurts the moral end user, not the pirate who can get past it easily. That, again, is a very interesting statement.
Well, it's like when you buy a legitimate DVD and then you're presented with that video. You wouldn't do this and you wouldn't do that, so don't download this film. I didn't. I bought it.
I paid for this.
This is mine. Yeah. Why am I being made to feel bad for having actually done the right thing?
Yeah. So it's certainly interesting. And I think that the real thing to take away is that nobody's got this right yet. And we need to try and we need to try and look at what the best way to do that is. Amanda says it's also debatable as to whether some piracy actually balloons sales. And this is kind of a case study that I've heard so many times before. A friend of mine got really into Evanescence a few years ago. I like Evanescence, I have to say. And said obviously nameless friend pirated. Kind of off Torrent or Napster or whatever it was at the time, Evanescence's music, got really into it and subsequently went to see them about 8 times, bought a load of merchandise and ended up buying the albums, and actually pumped a lot of money into that revenue generating system as a result of having initially pirated it. So should there be some kind of try before you buy that makes that form of piracy legal? It's a very interesting debate.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head with you have a little taster of something for free, or perhaps in a way that you maybe shouldn't have, but that can spark a real interest in something. It's happened to me with several artists. I think back to like Tenacious D way back, when their first album came out. I'd heard that song, a friend had downloaded it and said, hey, he was singing it in school one day and I was like, what's that? And he sort of played it to me, and now, I think they're brilliant. But if that sort of seed hadn't been sown, if he hadn't got hold of that file, maybe it would have turned out differently. And
well, absolutely. And I think the thing to think here is that there is nothing here that is right yet. Nobody has got it right. Nobody has sat down and thought, this is how we can end piracy, be good for users, make sure everyone gets a fair deal and not completely censor the internet.
Yeah.
Liam's making a great point, one that we were just about to mention. Governments are just full of people who don't understand how the internet works. And hopefully that'll change with the current generation. So all of the people listening and all of the people that are protesting, we've got to try and act, but not necessarily in a burn down a government building kind of way like some of those unfortunate protests started last year. We need to try and talk to people, make people understand and help. help the industry get over this, because it's something that we can all do to try and make that happen. But I think for now the debate is very much still open.
Exactly.
You've been listening to The Geekly Chronicles, a Geekly production by Ben Nunney and James Marshall, engineered and recorded by Alex Livier and the team at Studio 2. Check us out online at www.geeklychronicles.com.